Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. A very, very special edition of the Original Gangsters, both the podcast as well as the Patreon members only. This is going to be the start of a series that we do where we get people from opposite ends of a legal conflict or a mob war in some cases. And we're going to get them after decades of not seeing each other and get them at the table to hash out stuff that happened back in the day and get some perspective. Today, we're going to be discussing the 1996 Operation Game Tax case, which is the biggest prosecution of the Detroit Mafia in the history of the Tocco Israeli crime family. And we have a former member of the crime family who was in that case, Novi Tocco. Thank you for joining us, Novi.
You're welcome, Scott. Good afternoon.
And then we have a prosecutor on the case, Rick Convertino, who is a legendary mob buster here in Detroit. And he put Novi away. And Novi and Rick haven't seen each other in literally 30 years. And this is the first time that they've been in the same room since Novi was convicted back in 1998. So it's been 27 years. And we're just going to kind of chop it up and see where we go. So thank you for joining us, Rick.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I guess I'll throw it to Rick first and just kind of maybe talk about the background and how you got involved in going after the Tocco Israeli crime family. And that 96 game tax case was a sledgehammer. It didn't kill the crime family, but it definitely, you know, it knocked them down for us, you know, for a significant period of time. All the administrators went to prison. It was 16 people. The case dated back almost 25 years of activity, going all the way back to Las Vegas. And just kind of tell us about how you got introduced to it.
To the case itself?
Yeah, how did you get put onto the case?
Well, I was a member of the Organized Crime Strike Force in Detroit in the U.S. Attorney's Office. I started my career in with Maine Justice in the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section in 1989. And I was assigned, among other areas, to come to Detroit to assist the Organized Crime Strike Forces in cases that were lagging in the strike force at the time.
And you were a New Yorker, right?
I'm from New York. Yep. I'm from Endicott, New York. And I can tell you some interesting stories about being from Endicott, New York, if you'd like, which have a connection to Detroit as well.
Yes, let's do that later on in the episode.
So I was traveling to Detroit and working on cases that were not being attended to by the strike force from Maine Justice. And one of the cases that I had been repeatedly asked to assist on was GAMTAX. And I had absolutely no interest in doing that. You know, I was kind of typecast as a, you know, young Italian kid who would be great at working on OC cases. And it just wasn't anything that, you know, based on my historical background, it wasn't anything that really was exciting to me. But how I got on the case was there was an attorney on the case who was on the case on GAMTAX a long time and was extraordinarily unproductive. It was the only case he was assigned to. He wasn't doing his share of the load. And so the chief of the strike force was concerned. And then finally, when the case was coming to trial, that attorney said he needed to have hip replacement surgery, needed to be relieved of his duties. So the chief of the strike force came to me and said, look, I really need you to get on this case, take over. He wanted me to take the lead with Angelo Polizzi.
That was one of one of the first dominoes to kind of fall in building GAMTAX.
Yes.
Was the son of a consigliere of the family, Mike Polizzi, his son, who was an attorney.
Yes.
Got caught up in
DWI case in Ann Arbor.
And then there was also, he owned a bar, I believed, in St. Clair Shores with an ex-Purple Ganger's son.
And they he flipped, like an old suitcase in about 30 seconds.
He wasn't a gangster.
He wasn't a gangster. He was a graduate of Notre Dame Law School. And, you know, it depends on what day you caught him, whether he was a gangster or not.
He was Jack Tocco's godson.
Yes.
as well. And Jack Tokel was the boss.
So the attorney in the strike force who was primarily responsible for presenting that part of the case, you know, was looking for an out, and he got an out. He said he needed surgery in his hip and it was unavoidable. So the strike force chief came to me and he kept asking me to do it. I was adamantly opposed. I just didn't have any interest in doing it. I was doing other interesting cases in the strike force at the time that I was involved in heavily. And so I told him, well, look, if I do that for you, I need you to help me with this terrorism case. And so he agreed. And so that's how I got on GAMTAX.
It's interesting when you look up, look at the timeline, and maybe get Novi to chime in here. Jimmy Hoffa disappears in 1975. And even though there's never any case that's brought in the Hoffa kidnapping and murder case, there seemed to be an impetus at that point to, even if we can't get everybody that was involved in murdering Jimmy Hoffa, we're going to get them somehow and put them in prison. So there was like this kind of full court press, let's say from like 75 to like 81, 82, where there were a bunch of cases. And then there was like a lull.
Yeah.
There was like 10 years or so, or
more,
10 to 15 years, where there just weren't really cases being built against the Detroit LCN.
That's right. That's right. And it wasn't for the lack of OLR, Officer Labor Racketeering, in the
department. It wasn't for lack of activity, because at that point, no, you can chime in here, but in the 80s, they were still a very functional, powerful group.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, they hadn't faded into the shadows like they kind of have now, where they still exist, but not at the level that they did in the past.
Well, I have one correction. I went down in the 80s. In the late 80s.
You went down in a case. Okay.
But I didn't have a trial. We pled guilty. In fact, one of Mr. Caventino's associates on that case prosecuted me, David Morris.
Oh, yeah. And that was the last case he prosecuted.
Was that right?
Probably so. Except for GAMTAX. Yeah.
Was that right?
They just couldn't get him off the dime. That whole strike force was the purpose of the strike force was GAMTAX, really. It was the focus of the strike force. It was the focus of the attendant agents working with the strike force and the IRS agents who were working with the strike. It was solely and almost exclusively GAMTAX. So if there were any issues that would arise regarding funding or regarding use of resources, that's what the reply would be. GAMTAX, you know, we're focused on GAMTAX. And that's why there was so much inactivity at the time.
And let me throw something else at you. And if you don't feel comfortable talking about it, I get it. Doing my research and digging into FBI intelligence documents and court files and trying to get a blueprint of how the case was built, it seemed like, from the perspective of a researcher, that there was a lot of attention being put on, and this was like 10, 15 years before the case dropped, but it looked like there was a lot of attention being put on a Toledo mobster associate of the Detroit guys, a guy named Bill Pompili, who was the inside man at the last casino that the Detroit mob built and controlled. It was the Edgewater.
Yes, the Edgewater.
Yeah. And there was a lot of surveillance from, let's say, 79, 80 through 83, 84, when that was all being done. Pompili died before the case hit, but it seems strange to me that you didn't bring, or that not you, but the Fez didn't bring the case sooner, because it looked like through Pompili, in the surveillance of Pompili and knowing what was going on, that there could have been a case brought, let's say, in the mid-80s to the late-80s, just on Edgewater, and it wasn't brought. It made me think, possibly, and Bill Pompili's been dead now for 35 years, but it made me think that Bill Pompili was somehow working with the government and they didn't want to bring the case while he was still alive. And Rick has no comment on that. You just look at a lot of the government files and what was being gleaned in 81, 82, and Pompili. Did you ever meet him?
No, never met Pompili. I didn't do much business in Toledo.
So Pompili was a Toledo racketeer who was a pit boss, I think, in the at the Aladdin, or had something to do with the Aladdin. And then when the Aladdin...
You know what? Now that you said that, I may have met him in Vegas at the Aladdin.
He went out there in the 70s at some point when a lot of the Toledo guys did in the 70s.
In the Aladdin.
Went from the frontier with your uncle.
Correct. Now I do believe I met him in Las Vegas.
And then they took over the Aladdin. And then when they got busted in the Aladdin, Pompili conceives this. It was actually a pretty sharp angle to play here, where he's like, all the eyes are in Las Vegas. Let's go build a hotel and casino 90 miles away in Laughlin, mm-hmm. where there are less prying eyes. And it was a payday, man. Yeah. They stole like $12 million from in 19 early 80s money. In a matter of like 18 months or 19 months, and then sold the place and got, you know, was in and out and made a lot of money.
Smart moves.
Good move.
Yeah.
So I guess to make it more general, like a lot of the stuff that was charged in 96 was stuff, some of the stuff was going on in the 70s.
Yeah,
because with the casinos.
Yeah, with the RICO statute, you can buy back, and you can go back 5-year increments, and you can, you know, connect those things that otherwise, under other forms of prosecution, wouldn't be possible. So yeah, it's a huge tool, and it's extraordinarily powerful. Especially RICO conspiracy, it makes it a whole lot easier to prosecute organized or disorganized activity if you can find an enterprise and then go back.
So the activity in game tax, which was charged in March of 96, some of the predicate acts dated all the way back to the late 60s,
yes.
early 70s,
yes.
with the infiltration of the frontier and then the Aladdin and then the Edgewater.
Yes, only by the use of the RICO statute. Right. Yeah.
So what are your kind of first memories of getting on the case? I mean, at Novi... The famous bug in Novi's car,
yeah.
I think, went up in 92, I believe, or late 91.
I don't remember.
I think it was 91.
Might have been 91.
Because Novi came back to Detroit in
91.
91.
91, yeah. I'd been released from prison. And I came back. I was still under supervised release. But then we had a little legal problem. The parole officer wanted to violate me.
And for meeting with people you shouldn't have met with?
Yeah. And I told her, you know, check your paperwork. I didn't sign the mandatory release forms. And so what do you mean? I said, that agrees that I would go on probation till the end of the sentence. I said, I MR'd, which means I did my whole sentence.
Yeah.
You have no jurisdiction over me. Go in front of a judge. And I walked out. And that was it. She had no, because I refused. I had been advised that in prison by another gentleman by the name of Belastri, who was an attorney in Milwaukee. Well, he said, do not sign mandatory.
He was an attorney, but he was also, according to the government, a high-ranking mob
figure.
His dad was the godfather.
And he was, and he advised me, do not sign your mandatory.
Johnny Bell, right? Was it Johnny Bell?
Yeah, Johnny Belastri. And he said, and in fact, prior to game tax, I contacted Johnny Belastri a few times, and he gave me some advice, incidentally, which Peter Belanca never would even consider as
and Peter smart Peter Belanco was one of the Tocco's attorneys.
Yeah, Jack Tocco and him were very close.
And the Belancas, I believe, I don't know if it was Peter, but there were some Belancas that were indicted in some of those casino cases, Frontier and
Peter Aladdin. Belanca. Peter Belanca was indicted in the Frontier case.
Okay,
I was in Las Vegas with Peter Belanca when they cut the deal. The Frontier.
So I would say that the two biggest dominoes to fall in the investigation fall in the direction of the government and helping them build the case was Angelo Polizzi and then the bug in the car. And that bug was up for 2-3 years.
Yeah, the bug was in there for a long time.
Because I got all the transcripts, and they go from like 91 to 94.
Yeah. You know who the guy was who was designated to go through every second of every tape was me.
That had to be boring.
It was boring.
Novi and Paulie Kurek. I mean, guys talking shop for 3 years.
Oh, man, who makes the best sauce and, you know, how many breadcrumbs you put in a meatball. And, I mean, it was. But, you know, that case, that the wires were, the interesting thing to me was the way they were done. You know, you were being surveilled. If you got too far away, the audio would break, you know. So they had to be pretty close to you during that whole time. It was extraordinarily manpower intensive.
And Novi's saying that he was having his car swept for bugs, and they were obviously missing it.
Yeah.
They were missing it because I believe you guys could turn those bugs off or make them to a frequency that they couldn't detect.
As a matter of fact, just as a total aside, in the case I had in the early 90s with Lorenzo Viviano and
Tony Palazzolo.
Yeah. They would do walk and talks, and they were very, you know, very shrewd, very careful. And so they'd walk through Greektown. So what we did was we put the parabolic mics in the parking meters. And so each one had a bug in the parking meter, and they turn it on and they'd walk to the next one. They turn this one off and that one on. And that's how they pulled those audios off the street, off the walk and talks. It was fascinating.
Even the car bug, which went in 91, that was pretty early on in the government's, you know, strategy of trying to bug cars. I mean, I think the first major car to be bugged was in the mid 80s with the Lucchese mob boss, Tony Ducks Corallo, not Corrado, Anthony Corallo, AKA Tony Ducks, who was the boss of the Lucchese's, was driving around in the Jaguar, 84, 85, and that was bugged. And,
yeah.
But I think that was kind of like the tip of the iceberg where people said, oh, this is a very productive way to get to glean.
Yeah. Well, Anthony Zerilli's car was bugged. And he went into a hotel to meet with Paramore. While he was in there, the Bureau takes his vehicle, puts it in the back of a semi, and started to, you know, to go to town on it. And he came out and noticed his car was gone and reported it stolen. So the Bureau took the car down to the, you know, near the Detroit River, stripped it out and left it there as if it were a stolen vehicle. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Wow. Yeah. Do you remember when his car was stolen when he was at the hotel?
Yeah, vaguely.
Yeah.
Vaguely.
Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't always work out, but.
He was going down Toledo too, a lot.
A lot. Yeah. You remember we referred to him in the trial, in your trial, Novi, as overhears, where the agents were in one hotel room next to the other. They took the cap off of the electrical outlet, and then physically, you know, yeah, Greg Stashko went down and FBI agent Greg Stashko went down and put his ear to the hole in the wall and took notes as he was on his belly.
Or they would follow them. I mean, I've seen a lot of documentation of agents following the leaders of the Detroit family, Jack Tocco, Tony Tocco, Mike Polizzi, Tony the Bull Corrado, and those guys. And they'd go to a restaurant, and the agents would take a table right next to them.
Yeah.
And basically just eavesdrop on the conversation.
That. Yeah. And that was the majority of Angelo Polizzi's testimony over years, as we called them, at the golf course. Or he'd nestle up during a meeting, or he'd be in the next room and,
hearsay.
Yeah.
The one hearsay he said on the stand, and he has a stone bald-faced liar, was that it was not common knowledge that if you wanted violence, you contacted Ronnie Morelli or Novi Tocco.
That's what Angelo Polizzi said on the stand?
On the stand.
Yeah.
But Angelo Polizzi had never talked to me or seen me in his life since he was 12 years old.
I mean, I'm not here to act as Novi's defender here, but I'll say that, and I'm not to say that Novi wasn't a tough guy. He was a tough guy. But I personally, in my research of the family, I never viewed Novi or saw documentation on Novi that Novi was some type of hitman or a guy that was famous for violence. Novi was a regular racketeer. He came from the royal family. Like, that's not... Ronnie Morelli makes more sense because he was a guy that... But, you know, they weren't using... You know, they were great at, as they say in the movie The Godfather, you know, we had a lot of buffers.
Yeah.
Detroit had a lot of buffers.
Yeah. Well, you were intimidating. You know, you were an intimidating, imposing figure.
You think so? I tried not to do that until I wanted to.
Well, okay. But when you wanted to. But, you know, there was no information about Novi as opposed to, you know, the extreme violent acts.
But just like when you talk about people in the Detroit family and the time that he was active, and you talk about guys that were, you know, would walk into a room and people would, you know, shake because they're afraid that bullets are going to start flying. You talk Bobby LaPuma, Bernie Marchesani, guys like that. But, you know, Novi was known as a racketeer. And when you're a racketeer, you muscle people and you shake people down, but that's different than, you know, or even a Tony Palazzolo we mentioned before, who we're going to do some additional content with just me and Rick. We're in the you'll see it in the coming days or in the coming weeks, where we're just talking about Tony Pal, who the government believes was the killer of Jimmy Hoffa. You know, Tony Pal, according to 302s and stuff, and they've a dozen bodies. But
yeah,
the Novi was a gangster, but I never got the impression from the records that I saw that, Novi was some type of go-to, if you need somebody to get rid of somebody, go to Novi Togo.
Yeah. I think you're right. Yeah.
And I don't think Ronnie Morelli was one either.
And Ronnie and Bobby were like a team, and it was more people were more afraid of Bobby than they were of Ronnie. Yeah.
Ronnie and me never saw eye to eye. We wouldn't even, in the same room, I wouldn't allow it. I did not like Ronnie Morelli.
Do you remember Ronnie?
No.
Because he would have died. He died before you got here. So you got here in 89. Morelli would die in 86.
Yeah, he died.
Heart attack.
Just before I went to prison the first time.
Oh, okay.
He died in Milan.
He had a heart attack.
Yeah.
He was supposed to come out in like a month, and he was going to have heart surgery. He didn't want the prison doctors to do it. So he said, I'm going to wait till I come out. And he was coming out around Thanksgiving. It was like 95 degrees out, and he's playing handball and just dropped. Yeah. And he had a family bloodline where they had a lot of their families had heart problems. So like, he knew he was going to have to deal with it. He was Tony Giacalone's like driver and protege in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And him and Bobby LaPuma used to be like, you know, they were the guys that you called if you wanted to get rid of somebody. Well,
I don't know about Ronnie. Ronnie was never made.
But
Bob was.
Right.
And I'll tell you the truth, I liked Bobby.
Everybody liked Bobby LaPuma. They were scared of
physically,
him. Within the family, I mean, everybody liked him.
I've said this before. Physically, Bob LaPuma was the toughest human being I've ever met.
Yeah. Hmm. And he was already, when you got here, he was locked up on a drug case, so that's why he didn't make it into game tags. He was locked up at that point. He went away in 89 or 90.
Yeah.
So, can we just maybe talk about some of the, you know, inside baseball of building the case? Novi's bug was up for 3 years, and then it took another 2 years for the case to drop. What are your memories of those years before the actual indictment?
Well, you know, as I said, I was not associated with the case until very late in the game.
Okay.
And so I came on just a few months before, and
you came on a couple months before, but then they have you in the front lines prosecuting it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, that was, so, I was a tough, energetic, hardworking. I felt like it was a mission. It was, you know, I was a true believer, 100%. I believed qui pro domina justitia sequitur, you know, which is on the great seal. I lived it. I breathed it. I loved it. I would have done it for free. I even had no idea how much money I was making. It just didn't concern me. So I was, you know, 24/7 in the job. And when I got assigned to that, when I, you know, told Keith, look, you help me out on this terrorism case, which I couldn't get anyone to help on. And I'll throw my hat in the ring. And then when I was in, I was all in. And that was what, you know, that was my role in the strike force. I was the guy who agents would come to. They could call me at home if they had a search warrant. I mean, that was me. And that was totally different from any of the other attorneys in the strike force. So when I got on that case, you know, I moved and shook, and that was, you know, I had to steep myself and learn every inch of that case. And by the time it went to trial, I was, you know, I believed I knew the facts better and the law better than any attorney in that courtroom. And the big part of it was preparing Angelo for trial. And he was probably, if not the most, one of the most difficult witnesses I ever had. My personal...
He felt conflicted?
No. I don't know what other word to use. He just was an incredible pussy. I don't know what else to say.
All right, I gotcha.
I mean, he was, you know, we go from sessions where he'd be crying in the bed to, you know, where he'd be coherent, but it was very difficult to focus him in.
Was he worried that like Jack Tocco was going to kill him?
Yeah. That was his constant worry. He was scared to testify in general, just to be up in front of people. It was very difficult to get him focused. And so, you know, my personal preference in the way I work cases, and I consider myself a trial attorney, which is very different than being a litigator. But, you know, I know my way around a courtroom. And so for every 15 minutes a witness is on the witness stand, I believe they need about an hour of prep time.
Right.
That's just my general rule. And so if you consider how long he was on the witness stand, days, you know, it took countless hours. I'd be in a hotel room with two FBI agents and Angelo, and sometimes his attorney. And, you know, and that's why I believe the other attorney really got off the case. Ultimately, he just couldn't deal with it. So it was a tough time dealing with Angelo.
And so even though, you know, Angelo was a conduit to building the case, and the bug in Novi's car was a huge deal in building the case, neither of them, I mean, even Novi, and I say this with all due respect to Novi, I mean, Novi wasn't the main target in the case. They wanted to get, you know, build their way up the ladder. And the main targets here were Jack Tocco, Tony Zerilli, and the Giacalone brothers, Mike Polizzi. And Tony Tocco, right. Yeah. So, I mean, the top of the lineup, the guys on the marquee.
Yeah, clearly, yep.
Did you, was there ever any discussion about bringing more violence into the indictments, charging murders?
Well, there were other indictments. You know, I know you know that. You know, there were the second tier of indictments.
Yes.
And those, just to give you an example of how sometimes incompetence overruled almost everything else. So that second tier of indictments, it was a time when they were going to be superseded. And when they superseded the second tier, they left off some people that were included in that indictment. There were 19 or something like
16,
that.
16 at the end. It was 16.
Yeah. Okay. It was okay at the end, but I think there were 19, and it was they superseded, and they simply forgot to add.
There were some unindicted co-conspirators.
No, I'm talking about indicted. So there was indictment A, and then they superseded with indictment B. But in indictment B, they just forgot to include some people, if you can believe it. And then when they realized that the people that were excluded accidentally, the statute had run. Statute of limitations had run. They weren't charged. I mean, it was amazing incompetence.
We can get into this a little later, and I'd like to get just to tease it out here. There was some possible shadiness in a lot of parts of that case. And I don't think they came from the U.S. Attorney's Office necessarily, but just in the way that things shook out in the laundry, Jack Tocco's sentence, and other
how
stuff.
How so?
Well, again, I think we're jumping around here, but I'll jump on it right now. But you know, Jack Tocco's convicted of being the head of a RICO enterprise. Mm-hmm. Every other mafia don over the previous 15 years that had been convicted of being the head of a RICO enterprise was going away for 25 years plus. Mm-hmm. And Jack Tocco gets a sentence of, you know, a year and a half. Prosecutors appeal it, get him to go back there for like another year. But at the end of the day, he ends up doing less than 2 years.
Well, it wasn't the U.S. Attorney's Office that was responsible. It was the judge.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I was saying. I don't think it was you guys. I think it was, there were some questions about.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. I'd never seen anything like that in, you know, 35 years of practicing law where a judge was so adamant about departing downward on the sentencing guidelines. So he did that more than once. It went back up to the Sixth Circuit. They remanded it. He did it again. It went back to the Sixth Circuit. He was just committed not to follow the sentencing guidelines.
And
that was not the Department of Justice.
No. I wanted to be clear that I hope I said that before I opened it. And if I didn't, I apologize. But yeah, I'm not. I wasn't trying to throw shade at the U.S. Attorney's Office. But just talking to people, and then we can get Novi's take on this. There was a lot of people that read Jack's demeanor in court over those couple months. And guys that were in the trial, guys that were observing, that just felt like he knew that he had some ace up his sleeve, that there was, I've heard use the word trap door, where he knew that even if he got convicted, he was going to be okay. That he kind of, the way he carried himself was kind of like he had an in.
Well, I'll tell you, I had a couple of interactions with him during the trial that were interesting. One was in the hallway at a break when he told me when this is through, he invited me to a nice spaghetti dinner. He was very pleasant, cordial, dignified, always. I thought would.
I mean, that was his reputation. I mean, he was a very refined, polished. He was a boardroom don, not a street corner don.
Yeah. Now, Ton was mean as spit.
Ton was the Jack would bark and Ton would bite.
Yeah. But one time,
nobody has an objection. Oh.
Ton was not my favorite person, but I don't think Ton was. Ton was tough when Tony the Bull was in the room.
Ah. Yeah.
And that's from childhood.
Wow, that's interesting.
I was surprised to hear, and again, you don't have to comment on it if you don't want to. Everybody's dead that I'm talking about here. But I was surprised to hear, and this kind of contradicts what I said a moment ago, so I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth here, that the royals in the family weren't necessarily tasked with a lot of the dirty work. But I was told that Tony Tocco did quite a bit of dirty work in his time. And had a lot of bodies and I just wouldn't, you know, when you talk about Jack Tocco and bodies, you're really talking about one or two situations when he was really young. But I'd heard about from people that, you know, Tony Tocco was doing work into later in his life.
Well, I don't know. I had heard that too, but there was not reflected in.
No, there were no murders.
So just to be clear,
there were no murders in game tags.
Nor were there any FD-302s that I've ever seen, FBI 302s, that which is a historical memorialization of a I'd seen none of that said Ton was, but I had heard that from agents, you know, that agents would say that what you just said, but there was no memorialization of it that I'd seen.
Was there any thought about putting homicides into the case?
There were efforts to.
Would you have had to tie the homicides into the greater conspiracy?
With a conspiracy, a conspiracy is simply an agreement between two or more people to violate the law in one act in furtherance. one overt act. So in a conspiracy, you can think of a conspiracy as a spoked wheel. And one spoke can commit an act and not have any idea what another is doing, or even who else is involved in the enterprise. So once you show the enterprise and you show the plan and purpose of the enterprise, then anything that flows thereof, including a murder that might have occurred in 1972, if you can draw it back through the RICO conspiracy, through the statute in 5-year increments back, then that could be would be included. But there was no conclusive evidence of any of that.
I think that the goal, at least in terms of one homicide, was the Pete Cavatayo Pete Cavatayo hit, which took place in the summer of 85. I know there was grand jury testimony from people that allegedly participated in it and then recanted that testimony. Novi, did you, as you were hearing about the case possibly coming down, I know you started to hear about it like in early 96. It came down in March. You start to hear that there could have been a case.
I heard about it right when the bug was still in my car. I had taken it to a Chrysler dealer, and they said the FBI's got your car booked. And the guy asked me not to bring it back there anymore. Anyway, and I got rid of that car after that. But it had already been in there about 2 years, I guess.
Did you think that it could have been a case that included murders?
No, I never thought about it. But then now that you say the Pete Cavatayo thing, I knew where that originated and where it came from.
It wasn't really a secret, at least on the street.
It wasn't a secret. And contrary to belief, Dominic Corrado was not protecting Pete Cavatayo.
Right. That's what something that...
he did not.
Novi has wanted to put out there, and the common narrative, and something that I've reported on, was that Pete Cavatayo. Well, this is what's true. Pete Cavatayo was somebody that was living on borrowed time for 20, 30 years. I mean, he was somebody that I have FBI documents from the early 60s. People going to your grandfather and being like, "We got to kill Pete Cavatayo." He just was somebody that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, and seemed to be just living a very flagrant lifestyle. But Dominic Corrado died in June, and then like 2 weeks later, Cavatayo was killed. The narrative was that nobody could have touched Cavatayo before Dominic Corrado died, because Dominic Corrado was his brother-in-law, and that when Dom Corrado passed, it was kind of open season on Cavatayo. Novi's saying that's not true.
No, that's not true. What is really true is that up until my grandfather's death, he did not want those children left as orphans. And then Dominic Corrado in the early 80s became very ill.
Sick.
Very, very ill. And couldn't do much. I believe he had heart failure, an enlarged heart. Problems the same as his father, which runs through the whole Corrado family. And that whole thing, Pete was in very heavily into the drug business, very heavily into the drug business. And
just the timing of it. And I'm someone who just doesn't believe in coincidences. See,
when it came out that he was making a lot of money in drugs and had a stash, that's when it became open season on him.
Because they wanted the money.
They wanted the money.
And he wasn't partnered with Italians. He was partnered with the old Purples. He was doing it with all the old Jews.
Well, he was doing it with a lot more than just Jews.
And black guys.
And black guys, yeah. And some white people I knew. Pete was going to South Florida and running kilos back here. It became known because a kid that worked for him had a loose mouth and started talking about this big stash. And that's when it became, and that's why he died as harshly as he did.
I know that within the grand jury, and I'm not going to get into naming names, but within the grand jury testimony, I know that there were some pretty big players that were named as participating in that particular homicide. And it seemed to be a normally, I think with the Detroit jobs, things are very tight and it's like a small group. This seemed to be a bigger group of people that were involved in this conspiracy in terms of Cavatao.
And talking about Greed.
Well, John Pree was the one who went in front of the grand jury.
But you're talking about what was rumored to be a very large sum of money.
Right.
And it would have been hard to get to unless you could force Pete to talk.
Right.
And that's...
They tortured him to get him to...
That's what I understand. Right. But that's what it was a large sum of money. And the people involved, the ones that you just spoke about, were, if there's any other motivation, greed was a gigantic one.
I just know there were two names... I have no problem saying that it was the Billy Jackalone crew that was suspected of carrying it out. Mm-hmm. But there were two really, really big names, or three maybe, really big names that were named in the testimony as participating. One of them not being, I'll say one name because he's dead. One being Taco Bowman.
Oh.
The Outlaws motorcycle gang boss. I know was implicated in the grand jury testimony as being involved in the homicide.
I did not know that until you told me at some point, but that does not stretch my imagination.
Well, Billy Jack's crew was
because of Frank Baum's connection to the motorcycle crew.
Yes. I'm sorry. Let's kind of make our way back to the actual case at hand. Novi kind of has an idea. This is coming down. Case was being built for, like we said, a long time. Different iterations of the investigation dating back 20 years. And by late 95, early 96, you guys are ready to bring the case.
Yeah.
What was the feeling amongst not just you, but other people? Like, was there just a sense... as 95 became 96, that this thing is coming soon and we're going to have to deal with it?
There was a sense between me and Paul that we're coming soon. We did not realize how big or encompassing the case would be. And we knew there would be at least me and him and maybe a few of the guys who were working with us would be involved. And we knew it would be an extortion case. I didn't expect a RICO case.
Did you have these conversations with your uncle? Was Tony Z saying, was Tony Z wondering what, if it was going to blow back on him?
No, he did not wonder that. He knew that I was hotter than a firecracker, and so was Paul. And, I mean, that didn't surprise anybody. I did not think that they would build a RICO case going back to Jack Tocco. Then realizing that with some of the conversations in our car, would institute bringing Jack in. I'd never had a conversation in my car with Tony Tocco or Jack Tocco, but there were conversations
about them
going to meetings. And in those conversations, those tapes, I mean, it becomes very apparent that I'm...
That you guys little, don't like them.
I'm disgusted with the whole concept that they're playing. And that's the way it goes down. I was surprised the day that the RICO conspiracy went so far as to arresting people in Florida. I was shocked that my father was involved in the RICO conspiracy.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. Do you mind?
No.
Paul Tocco was involved in that case, and you say that Paul really was not your dad.
Yeah, my father.
That
never did anything.
Wasn't really a wise guy.
No.
No. Did he end up having to do time in this
case? No. I got an attorney to bargain him down because how my father got involved with the case was so stupid. And I'm a little bit aggravated that the Justice Department would bring a case against a man like that. He asked me to pick him up at the dealership because he brought his car for service. When I picked him up, I said, come on, I got to go to the West Side. I'll buy you a corned beef sandwich because my dad liked corned beef for pastrami. And on the way, I says, listen, Dad, I got to stop. Just to wait in the car for me, I'll be right out. I said, but be ready to go real fast. Don't go roaming around. I go in, and I had to pick up some money from a couple of the guys who testified against me in the trial, both guys. And
some of the Chaldean bookmakers.
Yeah, two Chaldean guys. And I got in the car with my dad. I said, come on, let's go. He said, everything okay? I said, yeah, Dad, don't worry about it. Let's go. and he ends up getting indicted.
There was also one other thing, and I don't know if this played a role in bringing him into the case, and we'll get Rick's take on it in a second. But I know, and I've brought this up in some other videos we've done, I know that there was a conversation that your dad was picked up on with you, and I think Paul, maybe your uncle, where you were in the car and you're talking about the Taco Bowman, Jackie Jackalone beef and how they're trying to get you to go at Taco, and your dad's advising you, go see Tony Jackalone.
Yes, that I do remember that conversation. That's right. But you got to remember, my father knew Tony Jackalone from childhood, long before Tony Jackalone was involved in anything. They grew up in the same neighborhood. Their parents were in the same business. My father was in the produce business. And a lot of times I would ask advice from my father, especially when I had meetings with like Pete Vitale or Jimmy Q, because they talked a lot in Italian. And I wanted to make sure that I understood their meanings, because sometimes in the Sicilian dialect, there's subtle undertones to them.
Oh, huge differences.
Yeah, there's subtle undertones to what is being said and what is being meant.
Yeah.
Where my father had a complete understanding of that. His original language was the Sicilian dialect. And he advised me at that time, because I'm concerned, so was Paul, that we didn't like being pushed at Taco Bowman for no reason. He wasn't interfering with us. He was not in my way. He was not in Paul's way as far as making a buck on the streets. And we were getting pushed that way. And
What do you mean by that?
They wanted him to kill him.
They wanted us to
kill Taco Bowman. They had the contract.
Anyway, my father says, go see Tony Jackalone.
He'll fix it.
And Tony Jackalone will be honest with you, because I've told you this before. Tony Jackalone, I never lied to the man. I never shaded my conversations with him. I told him straight out the truth, and he gave me advice and straight out the truth.
Do you remember this beef that it came up in the case where allegedly Jackie Jackalone had an issue with Taco Bowman and wanted to whack Taco Bowman for infringing on dice games and backdoor casinos? And then it never happened. It eventually got squashed, but there were, bugs, the bug in the car had them talking about this.
Yeah, sure. A lot of things in that case never happened.
Right.
Which was, a big part of the kind of the allure of the case was that, you had the family, the
aristocracy of the Detroit underworld,
the universe of the Sicilian mafia in the United States.
Right.
Was here in Detroit. And it was, I don't want to say it was all sizzle and no steak, because that would be an overstatement. But it was a case built on nuance, interconnections, a historical case that if you took any piece of the case or pieces of the case, for instance, when you guys, exploded the device.
I did not
You know what I'm talking about. Yes, that became, a bomb. And
was that the John Carlo situation?
Yeah. Yeah.
Might have been intended.
We talked about this on our last video.
There's two different situations here, but go ahead.
We've addressed that. We addressed this on a video we did a week or so ago.
Going out and testing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was probably not much more than an M80 or a M60 or whatever, those little bombs are, those little, quarter stick of dynamite. But it became, something much larger in the scheme of the case.
Well, you don't want to be living in a community where someone's mad at somebody else and trying to extort somebody else, and they blow up or shoot at their house or blow up their house. I mean,
or shooting at the store when you guys were sitting across the street from, and you were going to shoot into, should we do it? Should we not do it? Yeah, no.
Shoot out the windows.
And sitting as the FBI was in an RV. They could have urinated on your car. They were so close. And you guys were going back and forth about shouldn't we, and you took off and you came back. And, so, So when you take those things in you know, seriatim, they're not serious things. They're not serious offenses. But you know, the specter of taking down the whole, you know, Sicilian mafia was overwhelming. And so taking a history of all of those incidents, compacting them together, it became a story of, you know, a very powerful organized crime family.
In that vein of things that look like they could have happened and maybe happened, you know, bubbled a little bit, but didn't explode the way that they mm-hmm. could, you know, in those wires, you hear Novi and Pauly talking about, what if we have to go to war?
Yeah.
Like thinking that the Tocos were going to try to kill Novi and Pauly, and Novi and Pauly sitting there in the car. I found this incredibly intriguing. It's before I haven't met Novi, and they're doing like a roster check of like who they have on their side, right. Who they can rely on, who can we go get, who would this guy be with us, or would this guy be with? So, I mean, it was, you know, pretty serious to get to the point where you're even having those conversations.
It was beginning to get very serious.
Yeah.
And probably would have gotten a lot more serious had it not been the case. Yeah. And that's true. The only thing that I had some questions about was some of the testimony, by some of the FBI agents. And I don't remember his name. It wasn't the immediate people on my case, suggesting that hypothetical situations that me and Paul would talk about, and that became evidence that we were going to do
the conspiracy.
We were going to kill a police officer. That was never an intention.
But they under the law, and you know, the federal rule is 801 D2E. It's a co-conspirator statement by a co-conspirator, which becomes non-hearsay, and that becomes evidence. So there's a, you know, it was an important part of the case to show the enterprise, the existence of the enterprise, how it functioned, how it was utilized, the hierarchical structure of the enterprise, and the co-conspirator statements were important too. So, you know, for instance, there were a lot of conversations in the car about John Carlo Cantanucci.
That's his real name, John Cantanucci.
Yeah,
right.
John Carlo.
I don't know. I know his name is John Carlo. I didn't know.
It's a construction company. His real name isn't John Carlo.
No,
the company's called John Carlo.
Yeah.
Yeah. It may be Cardinacci.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
And, you know, the discussions back and forth, I mean, if you listen to those in a vacuum, they were brutal. You know, should we kill him? No, don't kill him. You know, break his legs, make him so he can't move or walk, you know.
And Tony Z was giving some of this instruction to Novi and Pauly.
And then I can't remember the guy. It's a martial artist who played baseball too, that you guys were going to go to have the actual.
Oh.
What was his name?
The young guy?
Yeah, the young kid.
Frankie Witcher?
Yeah, it was Witcher.
Yeah. Witcher. Witcher.
Witcher, yeah. Witcher, right? Witcher?
Yeah. Frank Witcher.
He died a couple years ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You know, so, I mean, it was no joke. If you're listening to that, you know, it was a plan and scheme to, you know, to kick
that one. I understand. That one I understood. It was the one hypothetical situation that me and Paul are planning to kill cops, or the way it was presented in court.
Cops or FBI agents?
Anybody, police or FBI agents, and shooting out windows and getting pulled over would have not been considered a dire situation where you'd have court on the street.
Yeah.
You never shot out the windows of a cop's house?
No. That's not what I mean. I mean, there was a conversation in the car that if we had to do some serious work and you got stopped on the way out.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah, yeah.
And you might as well have court on the street. That was hypothetical, but that was depicted along with some of the defense attorneys in our case that me and Paul were mad dog killers.
Well, rightfully so. With all due respect, because you're what's in your heart and mind is unknown to the listener. Other than what you're saying, and you're saying a way.
If it's done in context, they know what's in your heart.
But Novi, just to play devil's advocate, you know, one of the famous lines from defense attorneys talking about how brutal having to deal with a tape on your client is, you can't cross examine a wire.
Right.
Right. Like the wire speaks for itself. There's no way that.
All right.
I'm sure you'll agree. Sitting there in the sterility of the courtroom, you know, in ultra silence, and hearing your voice being played over a loudspeaker to a jury, it takes on a totally different context.
Okay. It's
powerful.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, really, you can't, I mean, and not to reemphasize it, but like a tape is so dangerous. I mean,
it is.
Getting caught on a tape and having that tape played in front of a jury is, it's such a trump card.
Because it is. It's the witness testifying.
Yeah.
Literally testifying.
Right.
As if you're on the witness stand, you know, it's an admission.
And as now to Novi's point, which is true too, I think, context can be lost. And it can be lost in the sense of giving you, the person that's saying it, the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Like the benefit of the doubt that, oh, he's not, they're just talking tough. But when it's being played and it's, you know, raw, unadulterated, the words, you don't have any of that context.
Yeah.
Well, you're true. And then that's where some of our defense attorneys fell down on their job.
Yeah. Well, I know a big part of the defense for you and Paulie was, you know, with all due respect, you're just kind of just buffoonish, talking about sauce, talking about, you know, where you're going to eat, talking about, you know, trying to blow up something that was nothing more than a couple of firecrackers in a can. It's not a bomb. And I think in particular, Bob Morgan was very effective, Paulie's attorney.
Well, I agree with you. Bob Morgan was one of the better attorneys on the case.
He really was.
If not the best one in our case specifically, I think Harold Gerowitz was a very effective attorney.
Gerowitz is an excellent attorney as well. He is a very good attorney. But
I believe some of the other attorneys in our case, their cross-examinations, when there was any, was pointing to me and Paul.
So would you say that, would you agree from a perspective of being on the prosecutor's table that on the other side you had and I'm asking you if this is true, I don't know if it's true, I'm asking your opinion on it, that there was a concerted effort by Jack and Tawn and that side of the case to push everything onto Novi and Paulie.
Yeah,
like this was Novi and Paulie's, had nothing to do with us.
No doubt.
And they got thrown under the bus at the...
Yeah,
in court,
it was a concerted effort by us to make sure that that wasn't an effective defense. Right. But that is what, you know, was the clear sense in that courtroom throughout, was that these guys pulled us in. They're the culpable figures. We're just, you know, a group of.
It really wasn't a consolidated defense where all the defense attorneys were working in coordination to help the greater good. It was kind of like divide and conquer.
Even in the motions practice, you could see that where there were, you know, the motions were drafted to kind of depict and push things off on Novi and Paulie.
Yeah. And I think one of the most. I don't know if eloquence is the right way to describe it, but you know, the part of the wire, which kind of says it all, was at the end of one of these conversations that you guys were having about who would be with who if things went violent. I think it was you. I'm pretty sure it was you who said, you know what, at the end of the day, I actually don't think anything's going to happen because my uncle, who's 7 years old, has been brought up to not want his relative shooting it out on the street when everybody should be collecting their Social Security. Something along those lines, like, that's not the way that this thing was built. My grandfather, the way that your uncle would never go along with some type of violent dispute, because who wants to have, you know, you and your cousins trying to kill each other and have the newspapers covering it?
I don't remember that conversation, but that would have been a... something I might have said, yes.
No, but you think at the time, you think your uncle could have stopped something from developing?
No, I think they would have taken him out, too.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Well, there was, at that point, there was no love lost between Jack and Tony Z.
No, I think he might have gone there to try to protect me, but he would have been.
That would be my sense, too.
Because I know that, that the rift had become that big.
And Tony Z was separated from the trial. So let's kind of get to the actual March 98, the trial, or I think it started in February and ended at the end of March, I believe.
I think it was like January.
So maybe it starts in January. Starts in January, yeah, ends in March.
I want to say April, but
okay. All right,
I think it was April.
Okay, yeah. It was a long trial. Three months. Some of the big players are separated. So Tony Cirilli gets separated out. He doesn't go to trial to 02.
His health was
poor. Tony Jackalone had health issues. He gets out of the case. He dies before he can go to trial. Billy Jackalone pleads out and allocutes in order to get a shortened sentence, which was somewhat controversial, where he was the first member of the mafia in Detroit to go in front of an open court and acknowledge that there was a Tocco Cirilli crime family, that he was a part of it. And that got him a 6-year sentence as opposed to what would have been a 15, 20-year sentence. And he was already old and would have died in prison if he didn't do that. So when trial hits in January 98, it's Tony Tocco, Jack Tocco, Novi, Pauly. Was Mike Polizzi?
No.
Al Corrado.
Mike Polizzi had died.
Tony the Bull Corrado. Tony the Bull Corrado. Yeah. Right. Mike Polizzi died in 97. You're right. So that's another person that was indicted that didn't make it to the trial.
Right.
So the big names, I guess, would have been Tony the Bull, Jack Tocco, Tony Tocco.
Correct.
Were the big names at the trial.
Yes.
Tony Tocco ends up being acquitted. He's the only one that's acquitted in the case.
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Why was he acquitted?
This
is something that I've actually never really discussed with an attorney on the case. I know he was acquitted, but I wasn't really sure what the reasoning behind it was.
He was not the testimony adduced at trial was not as far reaching into his involvement clearly as the others.
Did you catch him on any wires?
No.
The Tocos are pretty conscious of being surveilled.
Very audio. The old school guys were always conscious of that.
So what are your memories of the first part of that trial, opening arguments, and what was the vibe? I know that was at a point now where the Detroit media was still covering OC. I'm the only one left. You know, the mainstream news here doesn't really report on this stuff 30 years later. But back then, they were. There was a lot of coverage on the news and the newspaper. A lot of coverage.
I think it was front page just about every day, if not every day. It was a dynamic, incredibly well-attended. The courtroom was always packed every day. There were the testimony went in unimpeded. There were a couple of things that we prepared for, never came to fruition, that we were, concerned about in the presentation of evidence. One was the photograph, for instance, of Jack Tocco being made
the boss.
Was taken by Special Agent Stashko, who had, by all admission, trespassed on the grounds of the game farm, and he crawled on his belly. And
just for people that don't know that are watching this, there was a very famous FBI photo that was snapped in the summer of 1979 at the Timberland Game Ranch, which was up by Ann Arbor.
Yeah, Dexter, I think.
It was a meeting held to elect Jack Tocco the boss, the next boss of the family. It was about a year and a half after Novi's grandfather had passed away, who had been the Don for 40 years. And all the capos that were free, Tony Jack was locked up at that point, but all the capos that were free all went up to the game ranch and they voted Jack in as boss. And they had like a little bit of a celebration. Yeah. They were out on a patio.
Right.
FBI got tipped off to the fact that this was going on, and Greg Stashko goes on the property without a search warrant,
right,
and snaps this photo, which became pretty historic.
So, and incidentally, it came about kind of fortuitously. The FBI, they were out on surveillance on kind of routine surveillance, and they noticed people collecting up and heading out. They knew something was going on because all these people, you know, everyone was Frank who had the, never gotten together
Frank
before.
Frank the Bomb was going around in a, like a van, yeah. picking people up and driving them up there.
Yeah. Who had never been together before, right. in one meeting. So that's what led to the
Novi, were you,
hypervigilance.
Were you in summer of 79? Were you here?
No, I was living in Arizona.
Did you hear about this, yeah, this event?
Yeah. Yeah, I heard about it.
And Tony Z was not there.
Yes.
He would not go there.
Yeah. He was not there.
Yeah.
So during the trial, I knew that would be a huge, huge part of cross-examination of Stashkill. And some of the others in the office thought that, you know, it can't be brought up. You know, it's outside the scope of his testimony. But I knew that would come up in cross-examination. I knew the judge would let it in as well. So, you know, people were telling me, you don't have to prepare him, Stashkill. You don't have to worry about him being crossed on that because it's, quote, outside the scope of direct examination, which was not under the rules of evidence available for cross. Well, of course, they cross-examined him extensively on it. He was well prepared for it. And so those things that normally in a trial, you know, you're always expecting the unexpected. You're worried about certain pieces of evidence coming in the way you want them to, and other pieces not getting in at all, et cetera. I mean, trial is like warfare. And so in that vein, there was nothing in that trial that was impeded as to the inclusion of evidence. There was nothing unexpected that came in or didn't come in. And so it was a pretty smoothly run affair.
Did any of the defendants testify on their own behalf?
No.
Was there any talk about defendants? Did you ever thought about going up?
I offered to take the stand and take responsibility for everything that I could take responsibility for. It was turned down, but my quote was, I want $100,000 from everybody so my wife doesn't have to worry about life.
And what was your feeling from the prosecutor's table as the trial was going on? Did you guys feel like this is going well for us? The jury's following what we're giving them. It's not too complicated. And was it like momentum building in terms of like feeling strong about getting a victory in the trial? Or was it something that like by the time the trial ended, you thought it was a toss up, like it could go either way?
Oh, hell no. Didn't think it was a toss up at all. You know, I do a critical path method in preparation for a trial, which is to draw physically draw on a whiteboard, you know, your critical path to each and every, you know, ultimate goal throughout the trial. And I segregated those out into the casinos, the bugs, into various sections of the case. And we'd come back. I would come back, and I would take it as a prize fighter, mandatory 10-point round. And I can't think of one day that I came back and thought it wasn't at least a 10-9 for us. I don't think that at any point in time I thought the defense was ahead, even for a day.
I'll agree with that.
Yeah,
I agree completely with that.
Just from a tactical point of view, there were a couple really, really good federal criminal attorneys that I don't think made it into the case. D-Day Loren, I think, was representing Billy, right?
Excellent attorney.
And D-Day wasn't at trial.
Yeah, but he was representing somebody else.
He was.
He wasn't representing Billy?
No.
No, he was conflicted.
There was a conflict there. Yeah.
So you didn't have. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, in terms of like who could have been big guns for the bad guys, D-Day wasn't in the case.
No.
Steve Fishman wasn't in the case. Fish doesn't do wise guys.
Fishman does. Fishman was a defense attorney in the Jerry Weidike case that I had. You know, and Fishman has an ability probably like no other defense attorney I've seen, because he doesn't have a prosecutorial background.
Right.
Fishman can take a 302 on an incident that he has no knowledge of, people he has no knowledge of, He can scan that 302 in about 30 seconds and then cross the hell out of somebody as if he had been married to that case, you know, since its inception. He's an excellent, excellent
Steve Fishman,
courtroom attorney.
Yeah, Fish. Well, let's kind of, I guess, contextualize what I said about not representing wise guys. I think he, from knowing Fish and talking to him, he said that he's hesitant to take on, over the years, he's been hesitant to take on Italian mob guys because his bread and butter has always been the African-American drug dealers. And I think there was kind of a precedent set by them where they pay a lot. They pay up front. They don't have any issue paying. They see it as like what we're giving you money-wise is worth it because what you're going to give us in return. And according to Fish, when you're dealing with the Italians, it's a different situation. They feel like they're doing you a favor by allowing you on the case. And getting money out of them is more difficult. This is coming from Fish. But he did, as you said, he represented in the Weedick case.
Yeah.
And I know, I don't think I'm speaking out of school here. I know he was taking money from the Jackalones to defend Frank Usher, the big black drug kingpin, Big Frank Nitti, who was convicted of a triple beheading from an internal dispute within the black mafia in Detroit. And Fish got him another trial and then beat the case on appeal in court. And I think from that point forward, that was in the late 80s, at least amongst a section of people in Detroit, it was like he can walk on water.
Yeah.
Like if you can get a guy off for chopping three people's heads off, then you can do anything. Mm-hmm. And I know that he would say that all of Usher's legal bills were being paid by Billy Jackalone and Alan Helf. And they would bring the money over to him. So you didn't have Fish on the case. You didn't have D-Day in the courtroom. And then Neil Fink was not in the courtroom either.
Yeah, right? Neil Fink represented Billy Jackalone.
Okay, so
Fink in my prior court case, Neil Fink represented me. But when we were indicted, he sent word that he can't represent me because Billy was his client prior to him ever being.
I'm just saying that the three.
So I just want to say something quick about Neil Fink. I've known Neil Fink. Of course, he's passed away now, but knew him for years and years. There, I would say, overall, somebody who's going to pour through documents, write powerful motions, argue them, and be an outstanding lawyer in court, which is very hard to find a good courtroom attorney. Neil Fink was probably the best, and certainly in the Midwest, he was an excellent attorney.
So the point I'm making, though, is the three best litigators in court for a federal case like this that were in our city for various reasons. We're not in the court defending anybody in the game tax case. I would
prefer to have Neil Fink, but
I'm just saying any one of those three guys would have been a net positive.
Yeah. Gerowitz, an excellent attorney.
I'm not.
Gerowitz represented my father, and then he had represented Tony Schmidt.
I'm not trying to.
Gerowitz represented me in appeal.
Yeah, but Bob Morgan isn't.
I'm not trying to diminish the attorneys that were on the case. Yeah, I'm just saying there were three like superstars, Hall of Famers,
Paulie originally wanted to go to Las Vegas.
Oscar Goodman.
Oh, that would have been a disaster for him.
You think so?
Yeah.
I don't know because I never.
I got into it with Oscar Goodman.
But then
earlier this year, actually.
Then
he's still alive?
Yeah.
Yeah. Then Paul ended up with
Nova. You'll meet him in July.
But Paul wanted to. We got Morgan because I do believe Morgan was a good attorney.
Oh yeah, that's I'm not trying to shit talk the people that were on the case.
No, we understand.
I do think that. I'm going to say it. Okay, prior to our case, Peter Blanca was a confidant of Jack Tokel, or Jack Tokel, you know, was getting his legal advice from him. I think that's why Jack Tokel hired his attorney. I think that's why Tony Corrado had an attorney from his office. And I think that's why Tony Tokel had an attorney from his office, okay? And I was warned by two women two of the old-time women, all right? My grandmother and Mike Polizzi's mother said, be careful of Peter Belanca. He's no good. Mm-hmm. And I believe that Peter Belanca orchestrated that whole case pointing to me and Paul Carreño.
How does Peter Belanca, though, if he had, did he not get convicted in that case?
He was convicted in the organ.
So did he lose his ticket and then get it back?
Yeah. I think so. I'm not sure.
Because D-Day,
he got it back, and he was
D-Day lost his ticket for a second, and then got it back.
He did lose his ticket, but got it back. And both of those two old time women said, "Be careful of Peter Belanca." And I'll tell you something: sometimes you got to listen to the old timers, the old women. They have more wisdom, and they were right. Peter Belanca was not a friend to me and Paul. And I got into it with Peter Belanca in a private meeting. I says, I'll make my own decisions. I don't need you to make my decisions for me. And he went running to Jack Tocco and my Uncle Tony that I was being disrespectful to. You know, I said, I don't give a shit.
Let me just point out something real quick regarding, you know, Hall of Famers. Because you need the, when you're talking about a complex RICO case that goes back to the 60s, you need, and voluminous pieces of evidence that could fill this room and probably, you know, two others, tapes that hundreds, if not thousands of hours of audio tapes, different, you know, financial records from casinos, et cetera. I mean, you need the right, you know, person who can do each component of that. So somebody who's just a good courtroom attorney won't have the tools at hand if they didn't sit, you know, through boxes of evidence and hours in a war room. So, you know, saying that, you have to have the right kind of combination, you know, somebody who's going to know all fronts of the case and be able to present it in court. That's a pretty tall order.
Was there a point, and I'm asking kind of the question to both of you, was there a point in time during the case where you said, you know, let's say after a date, we just won this thing?
Yes.
Or did you say during a time in the case, oh, well, this thing just lost it for us?
Yeah, day one.
Opening statement. day one.
Okay. I'll tell you one thing that I lit up my, my victory cigar was for certain, was when Bill Buffalino got on his hands and knees. And you remember that in the closing argument? Literally got on his hands and knees.
I thought it was a poor closing argument. I thought you got left out in the cold a little bit with the Bobby Rubino thing.
How so?
Well, because you referred to Bobby Rubino. A reference was made that Bobby Rubino was a person. It was a restaurant chain.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, and you referred to him as a person. How would you feel? Something like that. And then Bill Buffalino tried to make a big point of that in his closing argument, which I thought was silly.
Yeah.
Was it a restaurant?
It was a restaurant in Florida. Restaurants.
Florida, okay.
In Florida, in which Castellano had a piece, and Tony Tocco was talking to Castellano about it. And somehow it got in that Bobby Rubino was being extorted.
But it was a restaurant, not a person. Rubino. Yeah, I got you.
Yeah, and I think that you said it. I may be wrong, but...
I don't recall.
It was, and then he made a PowerPoint of it in his closing argument, and I thought there was no person for that. And then about cannoli Sunday and all that bullshit, that was all bullshit.
Yeah, I said, talked about cannolis?
Yeah, he talked about cannoli Sunday because it was, I don't know.
Rick said that? Rick did this?
Huh? Rick was saying this? Bill Buffalino said
it. Oh, okay, I was going to
No, you didn't. Bill Buffalino said in his closing, I thought it was silly. And, I knew that I was on thin ice with Bill Buffalino. But, you know, going in, this was going to cost me a lot of money. I still had a wife and children to worry about. Right. And Bill Buffalino owed me about $25,000, $35,000 going in. So, I'm market paid.
Well, Buffalino at one point, you know, they were talking, a big part of the evidence was the overhears in the Toledo hotel room where the electrical outlets were taken off, and the agent went down, put his ear to the hole, and then was recording what was heard in the next room. And so Buffalino was trying to make a point of the absurdity of it. And, you know, how could that happen? And he was like, had to be 400 pounds, right? I mean, no, he was huge.
At that point, I think he was bigger than me, and I was 380 at the time.
Yeah, and he got down on his hands and knees, and he crawled around, and he put, like, he was putting his ear, and we were sitting there, and I leaned over to Corbett, and I said, this fucker's not going to get up. I mean, there's no way he's going to get off.
Yeah, we were worried about it, too.
He popped right up.
What was the point he was trying to make to the jury?
That it was, you know, an absurdity that somebody would get down on their hands and knees and take, you know, because the agent was, the testimony was he took the plates off of the electrical outlets in the room that they were in
to eavesdrop
to the next room. And Buffalino's point was that's ridiculous. It couldn't happen. And he literally, you don't remember that? Him getting down on his hands and knees?
Vaguely. But there's another tent, I mean, beef I have with Buffalino. He was cross-examining about evidence presented against Jack Tocco, not against Novy Tocco.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
There was never a cross-examination in regard to Novy Tocco on any witness. From my attorney.
Yeah, that's true.
And so you're saying, but from day one, you had a bad feeling.
Oh, I knew it. Yeah, I was coming down. I didn't know I was going to get convicted of everything. I didn't think I'd get convicted of attempted murder of Taco Bowman. I did. I didn't think I'd get convicted of any bomb charges. But they convicted me, and then the judge threw them out. He says, you can't convict people on counts that there was no evidence presented against them, you know.
Did you feel like the judge in the case, I mean, you guys won the case, but did you feel like the judge had some favoritism towards the defense?
Yes.
Did you really?
Yes.
Why? Where at?
I felt that... I just, well, throughout the case and a whole series of things, including, you know, even from motions practice, that was my sense. You know, he admonished me repeatedly. He threatened at one point, I think, to hold me in contempt when I dropped my clipboard on the table.
I do remember something about that.
And then at the, you know, with the sentencing.
I just can't wrap my brain around it. And I don't want to besmirch a federal judge, and that's why I don't really want to bring up his name, but
O'Meara is his name. Like,
I cannot figure out any legitimate reason, where you would hit Jack Tocco with a sentence the way he got hit. Like, it wasn't even hit. It wasn't even a slap on the wrist. It was like a gift. It's like a gift from the legal gods that they gift wrapped and gave it to Jack Tocco.
Well,
like,
no one else.
Anybody
could
else would have never seen the light of day. Any other city's mafia boss that got convicted in that case would have gone away for 20, 30 years and would have died in prison. And Jack Tocco walks away with the best possible. He gets convicted and his first sentence.
Let me put
is
it
year.
A different way. Me and Paul both spent more time in the hole than Jack
and Paulie. And Paulie, right. I don't want to go down too much of a rabbit hole here, but Paulie Corrado did 12 years on that case. He was the low man, or one of the low men on the totem pole. And for him to get some of the grief that he still gets today, because of some issues that went on back then with people possibly wanting to fix juries and him feeling like maybe he was being set up. So he told his attorney to go sit. The idea that Paulie isn't a stand-up guy is just ridiculous. And I don't know what you know or what you don't know, but there are, you know, some people today in the 2020s in that group that shade Paulie Corrado for stuff that happened back then. Stuff with him and Billy Jack alone. And this guy did 12 years. Nobody did 12 years. Billy did 6. Jack did 2. Tony the Bull did 4 or 5 before he died.
I don't know. I don't. I know.
And Paulie Corrado did double, triple those sentences.
Yeah.
So it just seems a little crazy to me that instead of embracing him for swallowing the sentence for everybody, he somehow still gets grief.
And believe me when I tell you, Paul did more time in the hole than Jack did time.
Yeah.
In the hole.
And I guess
that's incredible right there. That's an incredible statement right there.
That's true.
Yeah,
so did
it.
I mean, we're not kidding around. Both of him and I, the day we went to prison, they put us in the hole because it was too high a profile case. And that was Paulie's first day in prison. And he was a little concerned. And I said, calm down, Paul. It's a brand new prison. We're in the same cell. We're lucky, you know. And I'm not trying to take anything away from Paul. Paul's a man's man. And I love him to this day. But he did a lot more time in the hole than Jack Tocco did time.
Did you know about the issues that Paulie had in prison with Billy Jackalone?
No.
Oh, so I guess I'm going to be filling Rick in on some stuff. We've talked about it a little bit on some of the stuff that Novi and I have done, but Paulie Corrado and Billy Jackalone got into a big beef in prison over what had happened at the trial related to somebody approaching Paulie Corrado about maybe fixing the jury. Paulie gave it to his attorney, didn't want to engage, yes. Thought he was being set up.
Right.
His attorney went to you guys, told yes. you what was going on.
Yes.
I guess Billy viewed it as some type of slap in the face to him. I think the belief was that Billy sent the guy to Paulie as some type of, like, I guess, gift. Like, I'm gonna try to help you fix the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they got into prison, it became a thing where they were sniping at each other in the yard. And then allegedly Billy hired a biker to get rid of Paulie inside.
Yeah. I had no idea.
So, I mean, and
Billy sent Superfly
right
to Paulie. Now, who do you think sent Superfly?
Right.
Please. That's stupid.
And, again, I don't know how much, if I'm talking out of school here, but you know, Jack, from what I understand, Jackie Jackalone to this day holds some type of grudge against Paulie Corrado. That just, it seems a little misguided.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I can't. I
think it was. Yeah.
I can't really get in. I can understand, and Novi has spoken about this, the belief from them, from you guys, was that someone's trying to set us up here. Like, this is coming from the government. Yeah. This ain't coming
Paul came to me first that day, and I said, this smells to high heaven. Somebody's setting something up. We got enough headaches as it is. I didn't want more headaches. I mean, I figured here we go. They're going to start tacking on time.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty inflammatory allegation.
Right.
You know, at the time.
For a guy that's doing 12, was about to go do 12.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was the feeling amongst the prosecutors at the actual sentencing hearing? And then let's say once you got out of the hearing and you guys were huddled up in an office or somewhere, like, what was the mindset of you?
Well, not to overuse a lawyer word, but it was outrageous, incredible, unprecedented. It was an immediate appeal started right that day, the work on it.
Did you suspect that was even possible?
No.
Because
it's not possible.
Right.
You know, I mean, we one of the things, in my opinion, the system breaks down at the judiciary, in general. I mean, you have a case that has a conclusion in one courtroom, and the courtroom right next to it with a different judge can have a totally different, outcome, sentence. And that's what the sentencing guidelines were implemented for, U.S. sentencing guidelines.
It doesn't seem like there's a lot of gray area there.
There's not a lot of gray area. And when there is gray area, it's litigated. And you have the probation does a report based on the guidelines, that's presented to the judge with a recommendation, and both the prosecution and the defense present their motions, for sentencing, their pre-sentencing filings. But you're talking about, a cataclysmic downward departure.
I mean, even if O'Meara would have gave Jack Tocco 10 years, that would have been a lenient sentence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he gives him a year.
Yeah. And then we appealed it. It was remanded, and then he did it again. So there's no, there's no explanation for it. Other than who knows what was in his mind at the time.
And Novi, what was going through your head when you heard that?
I was in the hole.
Right.
And somebody was hollering out, big mafia guy. I was in the hole. I says, yeah, I'm a big mafia guy. I just got 18 years. The other guy got one.
Yeah.
We got 1 year. The two guy, the lower end guys got the the biggest sentences.
Biggest sentences.
Well, I really appreciate you guys agreeing to do this. And again, you haven't seen each other in 30 years. So I'm guessing it might have been, you know, something that might be uncomfortable. So I thank you guys for taking a leap of faith with me. I think this went well.
I was excited to see you.
I was anxious to see you too. And this was no leap of faith. He's a very pleasant gentleman.
I think the same of you.
So hopefully, speaking of the audience, hopefully this will be the first of many episodes that we do like this. I'm working on getting people from prosecutions like this, where you get a prosecutor and a guy that they prosecuted, but also getting people on opposite sides of actual mob disputes. Right now I'm working, and I'm going to tease it out a little bit. I hope I'm not going to jinx it by teasing it, but working on getting two different participants in the New England Mafia War in the late 80s through the early 90s. One was representing the Providence Group, and one was representing the Boston Group. And I'm in the process of negotiating, getting them just like this. And they haven't seen each other in 30 years either. And they were trying to kill each other, get them to sit down and talk about it 30 years later. So we'll see if we can make that happen. It's been a slow but steady negotiation, and I'm getting closer to doing that. But this is the kind of stuff that we're going to be providing you at OG members only Patreon, as well as more stuff on the podcast, on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify. So thank you so much, Rick, for participating. And you, Novi Toko, my partner in crime now, no pun intended. Thank you for joining. Benny, who produced this, thank you so much.
Buddy.
And we'll see you guys next time. I'm Scott Bernstein for Rick Convertino and Novi Toko, OG Pod, OG members only. We're out.